my job is to try to put a little judicial perspective on the research and maybe what questions it raises for judges and judicial education. So my thoughts are going to be a little bit random in terms of the research that's being done at this point, partly because both these projects still have some work to do before they can really reach all of their conclusions. What they're doing at this point is raising questions for us and not necessarily providing all of the answers. One of the thoughts, just some thoughts from Dr. O'Sullivan's research project at this point. One of her first assumptions that's contained in the project is that custody evaluations have a great influence on judicial decision making, and that's really true. It does depend, and it should depend at least on the quality of the evaluator and the quality of the evaluation. It also raises questions in my mind, and the example that case example that was provided here raised some of these questions about whether we should be looking to having dedicated family court benches. In other words, whether we need to have judges who are really trained on these issues and just hear domestic relations cases, or at least that's the primary part of the work that they do. Whether we should be looking at the model of a one-judge, one-family model, so that in the situation that Dr. Sullivan's talking about, whether these cases are always coming back in front of the same judicial officer or coming in front of different judicial officers. It raises questions about judicial education and the need for the education on domestic violence issues, on child development issues, on parental alienation issues, on child abuse issues. It also raises some questions in my mind about the appropriate roles and expectations of the evaluators and the decision makers. I think Dr. O'Sullivan's comment about the fact that the expectations for the evaluator should be made very clear. The concept that we're going to ask somebody who's an expert, at least we're assuming they're an expert, to go out and do an evaluation and not come to us with a recommendation in regard to that evaluation, that somehow just because we got elected as a judge or appointed as a judge, that we're smarter than the person that's doing the evaluation, doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But that's so I would agree with her initial assessment that we need to be providing better direction and then asking for recommendations rather than just partial evaluations. But if we're doing that, the evaluation has to be worth something to us. And the other point raised, and I'm probably going to touch on it a couple of times, is that unless the evaluator is looking at collateral sources of information, that's probably not a very reliable evaluation for us. I guess I would contrast this kind of what the judge's role is in a family court context versus some other contexts we're in. Judges in a family court context have a tendency to view their role more traditionally in terms of being very passive. We receive the information that comes in front of us. We don't do much ourselves in terms of getting information. Whereas in the context of a civil protection order, for instance, particularly in the process of issuing a civil protection order, judges at this point are much more active. They're looking at other court files that are in their courtroom. They're looking at, in our case, an OGIN printout, which tells us all the different filings that have been made in that file. We don't do that in the family court context. We perceive ourselves as being back in this more traditional role. So it's an interesting dichotomy, and we rely upon others then to provide us that information, including the attorneys and the evaluators. That I found interesting in going to the research done by Dr. O'Sullivan in terms of what the evaluators were doing in the cases that she was looking at. And in only about one out of two cases, only about half the cases were they looking, if there had been a CPS investigation, were they even looking at the CPS investigation? In only one out of three cases, if there was a police complaint, were they looking at the police reports and that underlying information? Now, it's not that because a police complaint was made that is necessarily true. I mean, it is an allegation at that point, but it is something that should be raising questions that need to be followed up on and looked at further. And then in only 1 out of 6 cases were they looking at the mother's medical records. When those records, and these are when I'm saying 1 out of 6, these are situations where the records were in the attorney's file, so they're available to look at. And in only 1 out of 6 cases where they're actually looking at them. So I thought that was very interesting in terms of what wasn't happening, and as a result, I think obviously has a very negative impact on the quality of the evaluation that's being done. Because how can the judge or how can anyone evaluate the context of what's going on in the relationship without having the full information? The concept that I find troubling from a judge's perspective is this concept that somebody can, just by talking to somebody, looking them in the eye, figure out whether they're telling you the truth or not. And that's what evaluators are oftentimes doing, and that's what theoretically we're doing up on the bench. I cannot look somebody in the eye when they're up on the stand and tell you whether they're telling me the truth or not. I had a case on my last case I did Friday afternoon before I got on the plane this weekend. 2 people came in. It was just there were no children, and no allegations of violence. The issue in question, because it's a temporary support and who's going to pay the bills, is did mother 2 months before have a shoebox in her closet that had $30,000 in cash in it? He said she did, and she said she didn't. Well, I'll tell you the truth, and I told him I don't have a clue which one of you is telling me the truth, and I don't have any way to figure that out. I know that you both lied to me about the income situation because it's totally inconsistent with what's on your tax returns, or you lied to the government, one or the other, but I can't divine that truth. And in that situation, I didn't have to make that decision. There were other bases on which I could make my decision about what the support issue was going to be. But in the context, if they were coming in making an allegation regarding domestic violence, just talking to them there, I wasn't going to make that decision. But if there might be a lot of collateral information out there that would help me make that decision appropriately. The role of the attorneys, where there are attorneys, just can't be underestimated. The best case I ever had an attorney try in front of me regarding a custody situation where there was an evaluation was a situation where there were allegations, among other things, of domestic violence in the relationship. And the 2 parties had agreed upon somebody to do a custody evaluation through their attorneys. That evaluation was done, and the evaluation came back and recommended custody to the father. The mother wasn't satisfied with that, and she decided to change attorneys, a very good choice for her at that point. And the rule that we have in our court is we will not order a second evaluation. If the parties have stipulated to an evaluation and we've signed the order proving that, we will not order a second evaluation. So that attorney did what the evaluator should have done in the first place. The attorney went and looked at all of the collateral sources that could have confirmed or proven not true the assumptions that the evaluator made when they reached the conclusions for their report. For instance, in relation to an instance of domestic violence where the evaluator concluded because there had been no complaint filed that it wasn't worth looking at, that it must not have been true, and therefore that was part of the pattern of the mother making up stuff, the attorney subpoenaed into court the police officer who took that report and the eyewitness to the event. And those people came in and testified, and it was very clear that there was a significant event of domestic violence that occurred. And that, if the evaluator had even taken a look at the police report, which they hadn't chosen to do because there had been no complaint filed, probably would have at least raised some questions in their mind. So I think it's extremely important that the attorneys don't just accept the evaluator's report either in terms of what comes in front of the court. Now, just a couple of other points, and then we'll open this up for questions. It's kind of the questions raised to me first from Dr. Saunders' study, his project, is could these same hypotheses be applied to evaluation of judges? In other words, if you're assuming that evaluators have these predispositions and that their decision-making might be based upon gender, personal family history, training, is that true of judicial officers as well who are making those decisions? And the answer, as our Supreme Court nominee indicated in some of her remarks, is, you know, how I grew up probably does make a difference in terms of how I view life in general and the lens in which I view cases that come in front of me in a courtroom. Now, it's probably a little more delicate to do that kind of judicial examination of judicial decision-making than for evaluators, and partly that happens to us on a daily basis anyway because the decision-making the judges make is much more visible than other decision-making because it occurs in an open courtroom. It's a reported proceeding. Everybody can come in there, and as you all know, judges have been criticized from both sides about how they view domestic violence issues. But it is true that the lens that judges make view cases through does affect that decision-making process. It has to. The decision-making that I do now is a lot different than what I did 15 years ago. That's my gender hasn't changed, my background hasn't changed, but my education has changed significantly, particularly on domestic violence issues. The other context in which we have to take a look at judicial decision-making, I touched upon this earlier, it's what courtroom we're sitting in. In other words, what hat we're wearing. It's interesting, in a judicial institute that we do for judges on domestic violence issues, we do an exercise where we give them, the judges there, three different scenarios. And in one scenario, they're sitting as a judge in a dependency court, a child abuse court. In one scenario, they're sitting in a child protection court. And the other, they're sitting in a family court, and we ask them to make decisions. They're given exactly the same scenario, but it's interesting. Their decision-making is different because they're viewing it from a little different context. The other thing that I don't think we can lose sight of here in this discussion, we're talking about evaluators. We're talking about cases with attorneys. The majority of the cases that come in front of us, there's never an evaluation done. The majority of the cases that come in front of the courts, one or both of the parties are unrepresented. So what we need to make sure that we do with the research, I think, is to, it needs to go out beyond just the evaluators and the researchers and the lawyers. It does definitely need to get to the bench because, unfortunately, judges are called upon to make these decisions all the time without proper evaluations. So, I guess my question is, where do we go from here? My question to Dan last night was, okay, we've got this great research, so what? But there are ways that this can help us to make better evaluations, to look at the role of attorneys in this process, to look at what weight we should give to evaluations, and to help us take a look at properly take a look at the context of domestic violence in relation to the decision-making we're making. So thank you very much.